The North Atlantic Treaty Organization is celebrating a milestone anniversary next month. NATO is turning 70 on April 4th, but among the celebrations of the alliance's past are real concerns about its present and future. Joining me via Skype to talk more about this is Daniel Franklin. He's the diplomatic editor at The Economist and wrote the magazine's special report about NATO at 70. And Daniel, when you look at the organization overall, how would you say NATO is doing?
Well, it's a very mixed time for NATO at the moment. On one level, it's doing incredibly well. First of all, to get to 70, that's no small feat. Not many alliances do that, so it's an outlier in that respect. And it's been invigorated, not least thanks to the actions of Vladimir Putin in Russia in annexing Ukraine and being generally more aggressive in posture. And NATO has responded very well to that. It's been incredibly active in beefing itself up. At the same time, it has a bit of an existential threat over it because the president of the United States, the most powerful member of NATO, has not been a wholehearted enthusiast for the alliance, and that's cast a shadow over NATO.
I'm interested in the fact that you mentioned Russia, and in some senses, it's almost like NATO has come full circle back to dealing with Russia, back, of course, at its founding, it was the Soviet Union. But I'm wondering if in some ways, you mentioned invigorating to the alliance, has that sort of helped NATO maybe refine its footing a little bit, having to deal with this same country that it's been dealing with over the years?
Yes, I think that's a very fair point. NATO has survived this long partly because it's changed over the years. Originally, as you say, it was there to defend against the Soviet Union and its satellites. And for 40 years, it was a bulwark in the Cold War. But then the Soviet Union collapsed. And in a sense, NATO lost part of its core reason for existing. It found new reasons to be active. It helped to spread stability to Eastern Europe. It went out of area. It went as far as Afghanistan. It went to places like Kosovo. It went to do anti-piracy missions in the Horn of Africa, but it was struggling a little bit, I think, to really justify its existence. And then along came a renewed threat from Russia, and it's very much had to go back to the core and back to its roots. And it finds itself doing the same defense against Russia, but with a much bigger organization, 29 members now, not originally at the founding in 1949, it had 12 members.
You referenced a little earlier President Trump and his feelings and some of his statements and tweets about NATO. Within the organization, how seriously do officials take what the American president and what this American president has to say and what he might do about NATO?
Well, of course, everyone has to take seriously what the most powerful member of the alliance says. And it's been quite disturbing at times to have an American president who has said, actually during the campaign trail, that NATO was obsolete, who was reluctant when he first came into office to publicly reaffirm the collective defense aspect of NATO. And I think that has been disturbing. Nevertheless, you know, he's made the members think hard and go back to first principles and say, you know, why does NATO exist? What should or could we be doing to make sure that it continues to exist? So he's shaken things up. He's also, I think, been encouraging them. One of his main complaints has been that the European members in particular are not spending enough, not pulling their weight, which has been a constant complaint of presidents down the decades. But he's done it more forcefully than most, and they're sitting up and having to pay attention.
Are there officials within NATO or other maybe member countries who legitimately think the U.S. could leave?
Well, if the U.S. left, then NATO wouldn't really be able to exist in the same way at all. The United States is so central to it. But there are people who are starting to think, well, we can't take for granted this American protection forever, and we have to start thinking seriously about what we do about that. And the delicate thing is thinking about how you do it without actually hastening that outcome. So doing it in a way that, for example, shows that the Europeans are starting to pull their weight more and that fill some of their own gaps in military capabilities without challenging NATO itself in a way that is complementary to NATO and doesn't duplicate what NATO does, let alone conflict with it.
Is there a sense, either inside the organization or maybe even outside, of how NATO will continue to evolve? I mean, you've talked about how amazing it is that this alliance has lasted 70 years. In order to, you know, last some number of years, maybe 70 or more than this, I would imagine it has to continue to evolve. It can't just stay where it's at.
Yes, and I think they're very aware of that at NATO headquarters in Brussels, that in order to survive, NATO has to continue to change. And there are some daunting things that NATO will have to adjust to. First of all, technology, which is changing very fast, the nature of warfare. But also, I think the rise of China is a huge challenge for NATO. It's not what NATO is designed for, but it is going to be influencing the strategic balance in the world. And in particular, it's going to be taking up more of the attention of NATO's key member, the United States, in the coming decade. So how does NATO respond to that? How does it both react to China itself, but also accommodate the fact that the United States is going to be more and more drawn to responding to China? I think that's perhaps the biggest adjustment that NATO will have to make if it is to, say, live to the ripe old age of 100.
Does it appear as though there is consensus among the member organizations about how to do that?
No, I think there's a lot of disagreement. First of all, they haven't all really started to think seriously about it. And there are many points where other interests come in that aren't necessarily, that don't take into account the security dimension. We see, for example, on technology, should European countries deal with Chinese companies that the United States thinks pose a potential security problem for the alliance, such as 5G telecoms? Should they become involved in the so-called Belt and Road Initiative of President Xi Jinping of China, which is building infrastructure, investing a lot in infrastructure, and there are concerns that that is a way of China building not just economic links, but also potentially security links in ports, for example, in Europe, that could be worrying in the future. So I think all those aspects of the relationship with China, which is becoming harder and harder to ignore, is something that NATO is going to have to grapple with too and develop strategies for.
That's Daniel Franklin. He's the diplomatic editor at The Economist. Daniel, really good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.